Hey, I'm Francis Lamb, and this is Splendid Table Selects, our mini-podcast about the stuff that makes us better cooks and eaters. Adina Sussman is a little bit of a hero of mine. I mean, we've gotten to know one another working on Chrissy Teigen's cookbooks together, and she is such a consummate pro. I mean, she's someone who will go to any length for her projects with style and grace. She moved into Chrissy's house, cooking with her every day to help her write her book. And later, she tested recipes while living 10 time zones away. So she's all in on all the cookbooks she co-writes. And so I'm so excited to see the one that she saved for herself. She has a new book under her own name. It's Sababa, Fresh Sunny Flavors from My Israeli Kitchen. And it's all about the food of the place that's always been her home away from home until she made it her actual home a few years ago. She's such a gift for sharing her passion for border-crossing ingredients like tahini, sumac, and harissa. And our contributor, Melissa Clark, spoke with Adina about it from Tel Aviv. Have a listen.
So, Adina, your book is called Sababa, and I love the way you describe the meaning. What is sababa?
Sababa is derived from an Arabic word called sababa, and it's come to mean in Israeli slang cool or everything's awesome. So if you say to someone, I know this is 25 shekel, but can I have it for 20? They'll say sababa. Or you'll say, I went to the most amazing concert last night, and they'll say sababa. Or they'll say, how's your weekend? And you'll say sababa. So it's really kind of a catch-all for everything's good, life is good, we're having a good time, and it's just like a nice capstone to a lot of events and conversations in Israel.
Most people's entry into Israeli food, I think these days, is tahini. You know, it's becoming more and more of an American staple. Why do you think that is?
Yes. I think part of it has to do with its sort of flavor cousin to peanut butter, which is an American staple. And I think it has some similar applications. And I just think it's versatile, it's a superfood, and it goes both sweet and savory, and it also, it's shelf-stable, so people, it's not one of those things that you'll buy and it'll, you know, go bad in a week or two. You can have it for a long time, and you can sort of improvise and use it in a lot of different ways.
What are your favorite ways to use it?
One thing that I did that was really fun that was inspired by like a summer soft serve that I've had with like a peanut butter magic shell is that I made a tahini magic shell for the book. And I made a labneh popsicle with chopped figs in it. And then I combined tahini with coconut oil and it made this amazing dip that created a hard shell on the outside of the popsicle. It takes about 3 minutes to make. And it's just this really surprising combination of a kind of a classic American application with a really Middle Eastern flavor. So that's one that I really like.
Oh, that sounds a recipe amazing.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really easy. And, you know, you can make it and dip your popsicles in it or use it on your frozen yogurt or ice cream. And then you can just pop it in the fridge and rewarm it in the microwave in a minute or so or in a bath of warm water. So it's something that you can keep and kind of reuse. I have a recipe for tahini blondies that's been really popular. It's something that people are familiar with, a blondie with a different flavor profile. It's got a rich tahini flavor and cardamom and toasted black and white sesame seeds and a little bit of black pepper. So it looks familiar, but it tastes a little bit surprising, but not too surprising. And, you know, a lot of the book is about this American woman who moved to Israel a few years ago and how I fuse my two cooking traditions together. So that's another example, both on the sweet side. And then there's a recipe for tahini glazed carrots where you do a traditional roasted carrot and then you mix silan, which is date molasses or date syrup, and tahini with lemon juice and water and a little bit of cayenne pepper and cumin. And it makes this really lovely glaze that you ribbon over the top of the carrots. And it just amps up the flavor so much and makes them really delicious.
I made that one actually out of your book and I loved it. I thought it was, the tahini glaze was so delicious. I wanted to eat it on everything. And it made me want to ask you about the silan, is that how you say it? The date syrup?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that is an ingredient that I hope we see more recipes for and that becomes more available. I want that to be the next tahini because it was so rich. So tell us exactly what this date syrup is and also, you know, where other ideas for using that one as well.
Sure. So silan is derived from typically from medjool dates. And dates are one of the seven ancient species in the land of Israel. And so the dates actually have a really rich history here. And date syrup is made by boiling dates with water for quite a long time and then straining out the liquid. And it becomes this thick, viscous, almost, I don't know if you noticed, but it has like a little bit of that molassesy richness without the sulfuric compound. So it's just really caramely and deep, and it has a dark color. And, you know, it's really wonderful for adding like a deep sugary flavor to things. So I use it to sweeten salad dressings. I put it in sometimes in stews. When I feel like a stew is too savory, I'll add a drop of Ceylon to it to sort of round it out. I have used it. I drizzle it on ice cream all the time. It's wonderful just like as a swirl in tahini. It's very traditional here at a breakfast buffet. You'll have, you know, a huge array of cheeses and salads and fresh fruits. And then there's usually a little dish of tahini, and often there's some Ceylon swirled through it.
Oh, okay. That sounds, all of that sounds amazing. And I, since I have it now, I know exactly how to use it. One of the things I loved about your book is the way you describe your daily ritual of visiting the market with Shuk. Can you describe that for us? You know, tell us about the colors, the sounds, the smells.
You know, in the city of night owls, I'm often the first person in the Shuk. And it sounds like a little bit like a painterly description of something, but it's actually the truth. I'm often surprised that I'll show up at 7 in the morning and I'll be there before the vendors. So I'll walk around I'll find the places that are open, or I'll have a coffee. I'm a morning person to start with, but I love walking into the Shuk and seeing the expanse of these ragtag awnings stretching ahead of me, and I feel the breeze of the beach behind me. And usually someone is using a paring knife or a scissor to trim the brown bits off of some fresh herbs, or to chop the bottoms off of some scallions, or if it's fresh green garlic season, then they're sort of peeling off some of the outer layers to prepare things. There's a little coffee alley, I wouldn't even call it a shop, where his business is he prepares coffees for all the vendors in the Shuk. So there's this guy walking through with a beautiful traditional round Arabic coffee tray with glasses of Turkish coffee or milky coffee or mint tea. And there's just this sort of feeling of a family and a community in the Shuk. And it's something that I really took to very quickly. Although I had a long history with living in Israel or in the 90s and spending some time here in the last 20 years, at the end of the day, I was still a bit of a stranger in a strange land. And the Shuk really embraced me, and I embraced it. And so it's a place that I love to start my day because I feel so at home there.
I love that description. I learned something very important when I was reading your book. I've learned many things, but this thing, this is something that I had just never thought about, that in Israel, Israeli couscous is not called Israeli couscous. So I was like, oh. I mean, it should be obvious. So tell us, so what is it called?
In the 1950s, right after the founding of the state, it was what is known as the austerity period, where it was very difficult to get food in Israel because of all kinds of importing restrictions and a very poor economy. So Ben-Gurion, who was the prime minister of Israel at the time, he commissioned Osem, which was a packaged foods company, to come up with a round processed pasta product that's a little bit similar to fregola, like Italian fregola, but a little bit less sophisticated. And they called it ptitim, which are these little round circles. And the nickname of it was Ben-Gurion's rice. So like the joke was, oh, here Ben-Gurion created this thing. They're calling it Ben-Gurion's rice. It took off as an after-school staple for kids. It's filling. What you do is you sort of, you can toast it in oil, sort of like people do for making a rice pilaf, and then you just add the broth right into the pan and cook it almost to completion and then close it and let it finish absorbing the liquid. So somehow, I think it was probably a marketing ploy in the 90s, all of a sudden you started seeing Israeli couscous on menus from LA to New York. But here, if you ask people for Israeli couscous, couscous Israeli, they'll look at you very quizzically, like they'll hand you regular couscous.
Adina, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It was such an honor and a pleasure.
That was our contributor and food columnist for the New York Times, Melissa Clark. And Adina Sussman's new book is called Sababa. Adina shared some delicious recipes from the new book, and you can find them on our website, splendidtable.org. And I am super excited to tell you about our brand new podcast featuring Melissa Clark. It's called Weeknight Kitchen with Melissa Clark. And in it, you get to go into Melissa's home kitchen as she throws together dinner after work, but in a good way. It's fresh, delicious, quick cooking, and it'll help you eat better any night of the week. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm Francis Lam. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.